You're with SBS Radio.
Gaano nga ba kapalad ang mga ipinanganak at mabuhay sa isang bansang maunlad tulad ng Amerika? Isang pangarap ng maraming Pilipino na sa kanilang tingin ay mag-aahon sa kahirapan. Bahagi yan ng ating aalamin mula sa Filipino-American writer na si Elaine Castillo. Magandang umaga sa iyo, Elaine.
Hi, good evening from California.
Yes, thank you for taking this call.
Please, it's my honor.
Yes, you are born and raised in San Francisco Bay Area in California. How is it like for you growing up in your area?
Well, I grew up in a town called Milpitas, which is the town where the book mostly takes place, and that was a town that was really mostly Filipino, Vietnamese, and Mexican. So I was surrounded by Filipinos. There were Filipino groceries everywhere. So for me, that was America. That was very normal to me. I think, and, you know, most of the students in all of my classes when I was a kid were Filipino. So I grew up, and, you know, I had large extended family that lived in that town. So I grew up in a very Filipino community.
So being Filipino for you is not really different.
No. If anything, for me, that was always the universal. I think I never really was exposed to, I didn't have, for example, I think there was maybe one white student in my class growing up. And then I went to another school where it was sort of like half, maybe, sort of white students. Nowadays, I think we would think that school was really quite diverse. But to me, it was a huge shock. It was like my first encounter with, I think, what's usually called sort of mainstream America. But, you know, I was really spoiled. I never had any sense that what I grew up in wasn't the norm.
Yes. So having grew up in a community where it is so diverse, do you think you haven't really experienced any racism at all?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think within that, I mean, racism against being Filipino, particularly within that community growing up, I think I was sheltered from a lot of it because I was never a minority, you know, growing up. So I never felt sort of ostracized or alienated in that way. I think when I sort of grew older, and especially when I either left Milpitas or especially when I left the States, and encountered sort of racism in places like Europe or even in other parts of Asia. Yeah, I think that definitely was driven home for me. But I also think even within the Filipino community, we have issues around colorism, around patriarchy and misogyny. So I don't think it wasn't necessarily a utopia.
Yeah.
But definitely, I think I experienced sort of viscerally racism against being a woman of color and being Filipino in particular when I left Milpitas, for sure.
What sort of racism or challenges you faced during your maybe teenage years?
I mean, teenage years, again, I think the community that I grew up in was, you know, most of my friends were Filipino. I grew up in a pretty sort of active Filipino community. So I don't know that I would have necessarily said it was in my teenage years. I think it would be more when I started traveling when I was in college.
Mm.
I think in teenage years, it's really more the kind of subtle colorisms that exist within sort of Filipino society, you know, certain feeling that, you know, certain people within your community are treated a certain way because they're mestiza, and certain women are treated a certain way because they're morena, which I am. So, I mean, I think those are kinds of ways in which growing up I was aware of race and colorism. But I think it was really when I left sort of California in particular that I experienced, you know, the ways, just sort of the kinds of ways in which especially Filipino women are treated, I think, throughout the world, are sexualized in a very particular way.
Yeah.
That's particular to Filipino women and to Southeast Asian women in general. That's very different from how, for example, East Asian women are treated. I remember having to have sort of certain conversations, political conversations with other, for example, Asian Americans who I think hadn't really sort of realized that different Asian women experience racism in a different way, and that certain Asian women, especially sort of middle-class East Asian women, experience a kind of privilege that, for example, poor Southeast Asian women don't have.
Yeah, but did you realize when you were younger that I am in America, I am privileged to be here?
You know, I think when I realized that was actually more when I went to the Philippines for the first time. I think when you're growing up, if you're American, I don't think about it, especially when you're something like 7 or 8. You know, I was obviously aware that my parents were immigrants, that my mom had come from a kind of really brutal rural poverty in Pangasinan, and, you know, and worked 16 hours a day for most of my life growing up. So I was aware that the difficulties that we experienced being a kind of working class family in the Philippines were directly related to being part of the Filipino diaspora. But also that, you know, for example, like my mom and when she was giving birth to me, it was a very difficult birth, to the point where I think she used to tell me throughout my life, if I had given birth, you know, if we were in the Philippines, we would both be dead. So I think from that type of awareness, I was aware of a certain type of economic privilege that are afforded just by the virtue of being born in America. I mean, that, I think, goes without question. But I think it's not something that you realize consciously until you're older.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
until you encounter... You're sort of forced to name your own privilege, like going to the Philippines, being a kid and understanding, oh, okay, I don't speak Tagalog the same way. I watch different television shows. I know I grew up in a different sort of environment. Those are the kinds of things that make you realize that.
Like if you see the difference between America and the Philippines.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
These privileges or challenges or the differences between the Philippines and America, was this sort of the inspiration behind your book or novel, America is Not the Heart?
I think there must have been some of that, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, so much of what the book sort of delves into is, obviously, I think one of the biggest things the book delves into is class privilege within the Filipino community. In particular, you know, I think the family that most of the book circles around is a working class family in the Philippines, but one part of the family comes from wealth and privilege in the Philippines. And contrasting that, understanding how class dynamics works within the Philippines and within Filipino-American communities, not even talking about class differences between Filipino-Americans and white Americans, but talking about class differences between Filipino-Americans, between Filipino-Americans who come from working-class families and Filipino-Americans who come from wealthy Manileño families. You know, that's something that I certainly experienced growing up, because most of my, you know, the types of people that I grew up with who were able to go back to the Philippines once a year, all of those people were middle-class and upper-middle-class. We weren't able to go back to the Philippines that often. You know, we weren't able to afford that. So I think even thinking about things like that, like who has access to, you know, going back to the Philippines, who has a house there, who can, you know, all of those things are things that I think subconsciously influenced also my way of thinking about the diaspora and also how to write about that community.
Yes. For our listeners, can you tell us about the story of America is Not the Heart?
Sure. So the book really mostly takes place in the 90s Bay Area, the Bay Area community that I grew up in. And it centers around a woman named Geronima de Vera, but she's nicknamed Hero, also nicknamed Limang. And she's a former NPA rebel, essentially, so New People's Army, the armed wing of the Communist Party in the Philippines. And in the 70s and sort of late 80s, she's part of the NPA. She's subsequently captured and kept in a prison camp. And after being released, she comes to live essentially in exile in California with her uncle after being essentially disowned by her wealthier family back in the Philippines. So really it's a story about a woman who, you know, is a former NPA rebel who is undocumented, coming to live with extended family in California and sort of being part of essentially a Filipino diaspora, but also encountering sort of Filipino Americans who are born there and who grow there, and also her. She takes care of a younger cousin. So it's really about the kind of meeting of those different parts of the diaspora.
And you mentioned about undocumented person, isn't it? This is a story of many, I think, U.S. migrants or Filipino U.S. migrants, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. I mean, I had a lot of, well, I mean, I don't know if you know of that term, but TNT, do you have that?
Yes,
term?
Yes. Tago ng tago. Yes.
Yeah, I had members of, there were definitely members of my family that were undocumented for a long time until in 86 when Reagan gave amnesty, essentially. So that story was very alive for me. And then there was a member of my family, although I never met her, who was also in the NPA. And then there were sort of stories that went around about sort of relatives hiding her. So all of those things certainly, I think, influenced in some way the story.
Yeah. We're talking about your novel because you're coming down under this April for the Sydney Writers Festival, isn't it?
Yay!
Yay!
I'm so excited.
Yes. And on the first event that you'll be joining, you'll be in conversation with Winnie Dunn to talk about your novel. Yeah. And I think you'll be talking about the struggle of immigrant communities trying to live the American dream. Yeah. Like for you or for the community that you grew up with, what do you think is the Filipino-American dream?
Oh, I mean, you know, I think to some extent we're coming to a period of disillusionment with the, like, cliche idea of the Filipino-American dream after so many years of immigration. And I think there's an understanding that the American dream is not all that it's sort of caught up to be or brought up to be. And that I think we're coming to a more critical relationship with sort of idealizing America. Obviously, you know, the idealization of America also comes from the long, essentially colonial history between the Philippines and America. And I think, you know, increasingly, I think probably what's more important is for, you know, people all over the diaspora to adopt a more critical relationship to America, to the messages it sends, and especially to American history in the archipelago, which is really, a horrifying history, really, and one that's not taught enough, both to Filipinos and to Americans.
Yes, at sinasabi nila, for you to be able to really reach that American dream, kailangan mong magtrabaho ng todo.
Yeah, exactly. To be honest, I think my mom bought into that. You know, my mom worked, as I said, 16 hours a day. And the problem is that I don't know that that's true necessarily. You know, my mom worked 16 hours a day at believing that, you know, as long as she worked hard, then the American dream would come to her. But the problem is that I think, for one thing, I think it's a way of telling immigrants, well, the only thing that you're good for, the only way you should earn your keep here is if you just work a backbreaking job forever. That's your only worth here. But then the other part of it is that, you know, someone can work a backbreaking job and not ultimately be hugely rewarded, especially the way class works in America is that, you know, if one person gets sick, you know, if one person goes to jail, if one person gets caught by immigration, then sort of the entire family or the everything that you've built up can crumble. Certainly, I saw that happen in my family because, you know, because the women, especially in my family, were working so hard, they were all also, you know, pooling their money together in order to help each other. I mean, I also think ultimately that sort of fantasy of working hard being the way to the American dream, I think, has disappointed a lot of people also. And ultimately, you also don't want necessarily to feel like you have to work yourself to the bone in order to, like, have something resembling a decent life. I think, you know, especially in a place like America that has the wealth that it does, the fact that it doesn't provide for its citizens is, you know, a travesty, really.
Yeah. At maraming mga Filipino-American migrants, or in the case of Filipino-Australians, marami pa rin mga seniors or those who have retired already, they still wanted to go back to the Philippines. Is it the same way for seniors or for those retirees in America?
I think it depends. For example, my ninong, he came here from Pangasinan, and then when he retired, he went back to the Philippines. And my ninong and my mom are best friends, and my mom couldn't understand it. My mom, you know, because my mom doesn't plan to go back, right? She says. But my ninong did. So I think it really does depend on the person, on the family. I think if you come here and then you've got kids, I think my mom knows that I'm probably going to settle here. So she wants to settle here with me. So I think it definitely does depend, you know.
Yes, because if you'll be settling there, then it would be hard for her to go back to the Philippines, isn't it?
Of course, yeah. And of course, if you've been here for as long as my mom has, suddenly it starts to seem like, well, actually, she has more family here now than in the Philippines. You know, she has one sister in the Philippines, but she has sort of four of her sisters and extended nieces and brothers here in the States now. So
yeah. Going back to your novel, when you were writing America Is Not the Heart, what were you aiming for your readers to take away from this novel?
Ooh, I don't know. I think it's probably a hard question for any writer to ask, because I think different readers take different things from the novel. Like, I've had certain readers really connect to, you know, certain characters. Like, one readers really connect to the character of Fuss, for example, who's a, you know, she's a woman who comes from poverty in the Philippines, who ends up immigrating to the States as a nurse and marrying a man from a completely different class, a man who is, I mean, essentially mayaman. And I think people, there were readers who connected with her and her struggle and her sort of ferocity, her strength, but also her vulnerability. And I think there's also people who connect to Hero and to her political struggle and her struggle to sort of find herself in a new country after having gone through the types of, you know, acute political trauma that she's gone through. So I think, you know, I think ultimately you want a reader to take from it a portrait of America as we don't usually get to see. I think we don't usually get to see faces like these as being the heart of America or, you know, mainstream America. And I think for me, it's important to say, no, this community, these people, these languages, you know, there's a lot of Tagalog and Ilocano and Pangasinan in the book that is not translated, and that's done on purpose, you know, to show that these languages are also part of American, the texture of American fiction, and that, you know, American, if we're going to call American fiction American, then it has to include people like this because we're here.
It's like showing the diversity of culture in America.
Sure, yeah.
Yes. Filipinos make up 3.4 million as of the 2010 U.S. Census. This is a lot. This is a lot compared to compared to other Asian American communities, isn't it?
It's huge, yeah.
Yes,
I think
it is.
It's also, I think Tagalog is also the third largest foreign language. So it goes English, Spanish, Mandarin, and then Tagalog as the languages spoken in the States.
Yeah, and it's the second largest Asian American community. It's second to China or Chinese community, which is really huge. Yeah, but your novel is one story that really tells about Filipino immigrants. And as you mentioned, the stories that are not always portrayed in books or stories in America, isn't it?
I mean, there's definitely books. Thankfully, there's a wonderful history of Filipino-American literature. And there's many, you know, contemporary Filipino writers writing right now that I look up to. I mean, I would love to know about more Filipino-Australian writers if you have any recommendations. But there have been Filipino-American sort of writers and readers. I mean, the book, the title of the book is based actually on a kind of sort of seminal Filipino-American novel that was written by Carlos Bulosan in the 30s and published in the 40s about the experience of primarily Filipino and Mexican migrant laborers on the West Coast and the kinds of oppressions that they face. That book was called America is in the Heart, sorry.
Oh, so it's quite different from yours, because yours is America is not the Heart.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a critique of that book, yeah.
Oh, wow. But like you are inspired or you look up to him, isn't it?
Sure, yeah. You know, I think he's like a Lolo of the, you know, community, Carlos Bulosan. You know, and it was also the first time that I ever read a book that was about, you know, he describes, you know, the provinces, like the rural poor in the provinces, like in Pangasinan, you know, and those stories sounded like the stories that my grandma could have told. And that was the first time I ever saw, you know, anyone that was like my grandma in fiction. And I had read Filipino-American fiction before, and I loved it, but a lot of it was about sort of wealthy, upper-class sort of millennials, and I didn't know anybody like that.
Yeah.
So for that, I think the book was very, I think, important and affecting to me.
Yes. Now let's talk about your visit down under. You'll be coming for the Sydney Writers Festival. So you have two conversations and then a workshop. Can we talk about workshop that you'll be doing?
Sure.
It's on the 5th of May and it's called Rewriting the Canon, Fan Fiction and Other Radicals. What are you going to be talking about or doing in this workshop?
Well, this workshop is in collaboration with something, I mean, a project that I've learned about, which sounded absolutely amazing to me, that Winnie, actually the woman I'll be having a conversation with, is part of and has started, which is sort of about sort of literacy and teaching literacy and writing to, I believe, I don't want to get this wrong, but especially women of color. And so for me, I think given the kind of audience and what the brief was, it felt interesting to me to think as an exercise, you know, how can we think of, especially as writers, I think it's important to think of how we read as much as how we write and how we incorporate how we read into how we write. So for example, I think we get a lot of sort of mainstream stories and we get a lot of classic stories as readers and sort of just moving through the world. And I think, you know, especially if you're a young woman of color, you don't often see yourself in those stories. They're often, it's like, you know, people tell you like a story of Cinderella or, you know, a story of lots of Disney princesses. And most of them, you know, until like Mulan and Jasmine came around, they don't really look like you. So I think for me, thinking about rewriting the canon is thinking about the canon critically. And then also thinking about, well, how can we reimagine those kinds of, you know, mainstream or sort of, you know, huge kind of classical stories, but reimagine them so that we could also see ourselves in them, or that so that, you know, that we can reimagine them in ways that maybe criticize the kinds of messages that they send to us. Those are the kinds of things that I'd like to sort of think about and talk about. And it doesn't, you know, it can be from anything. You know, I think about that from whether it be Disney stories or superhero movies or X-Men or, you know, any of the kinds of, or you know, novels that, you know, Jane Austen or things like that. And, you know, the kinds of things that we receive as kind of our canon, our canonical stories. But how can we sort of actively read them, if that makes sense?
Yes, you mentioned about superheroes, X-Men, Superman. most of these are like, when you see them, they're white. But
yep, yeah.
Maybe sort of writing a story or a hero story where it will include Asian hero or superhero, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah, like Darna.
yes.
Or, you know, I mean, I think for sure, and that type of, you know, that type of visibility is important. It's important for kids. I mean, there are some limitations to things like positive representation, because sometimes it becomes, I mean, I think a lot of the times what we talk about now is like the optics of diversity, which is to say, you know, sometimes people can make something look diverse, but it doesn't actually sort of address any sort of actual inequality. So sometimes there are shows or movies or even panels, literary panels, that can pay lip service to diversity without actually doing the work of really addressing inequality and the sources of it and why we don't see, you know, yeah, Asian superheroes the way we should, or why the few Asian superheroes we see, you know, sometimes reinforce really kind of terrible stereotypes about Asian and Asian women in particular. So, yeah, I mean, we definitely need to change.
Yes, and you mentioned about yung paraan ng paglalagay ng mga people of color in stories. I think there was one issue here in Australia during an awards, like an award ceremony, or even in the US, I saw this one. They have to get this artist of color just to be in that award ceremony, and he's the only one. And they said that it's showing the diversity of, which isn't really, because it's just one person.
Yeah.
And it's very saddening if it's like that. Yeah. Like one person of color representing all the diverse of artists or communities.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's and the pressure, you know, there's often this rule of one that sort of gatekeepers often sort of unconsciously seems to institute. Well, it's like, oh, we already have a Filipino writer, so there, you know, that's enough.
Yeah.
You know, you're the one Filipino writer. It's like, well, no, you know, that's the last thing that I would want. If, you know, if you're a writer of color out there, then you want to open doors for people. You want there to be more Filipino writers. You want there to be more people of color. And it does often happen, especially on things like panels, or, you know, that you'll have a panel that you're the only person of color, and then you're meant to, I guess, be the representative on all racial issues.
Yeah.
Ever. And then the problem is that often then you never get asked about your work. You're just asked there to be essentially the workhorse to talk about, you know, so that people can feel better that, oh, we checked the diversity box because someone there is going to do the work for us. I mean, I really think, stop asking writers of color to do that work. Why don't we ask white writers about diversity? Why don't we ask white writers? So, like, what does white identity sort of mean in your books?
Mm.
You know, we never ask that of white writers.
Yes. For aspiring and emerging writers, what should an individual consider in terms of writing something about the reality happening in the society, say, the diversity or multiculturalism?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, I think ultimately you want to write in a way that is true to the work that you need to create. You know, I mean, if you're a science fiction and fantasy writer, I don't think that necessarily absolves you also from writing work that engages deeply with the kinds of things that, you know, we live with, which is questions of inequality, especially questions of inequality based on things like race, based on gender, based on sexuality. I think shying away from writing that stuff does a writer a disservice, because it shies away from writing about the texture of our lives. You know, I think that the idea that there's any type of like neutral writing, oh, I don't write political writing, I just write about people, that's a political stance.
Yeah.
And usually it's dependent upon the idea like, oh, I don't write about people, meaning, oh, I just write about white people and I never have to be called out on it because white people are accepted as the universal. Which is to say, I get to have the privilege of not being a political writer, whereas every immigrant writer or every writer of color is sort of in a default political just by virtue of being minoritized within a white supremacist society. Like, I think, you know, ultimately, you want to write fiction that's commensurate to the world that we live in. I think for me, sometimes, you know, you can read books that are supposedly sort of, I guess, middle class or realist, and it, to me, it seems more science fiction than like X-Men movies sometimes, because I don't recognize that world. If you write a book or create a story about California and there's only white people in it, I have no, that could be Mars. I don't know what California that is.
That would be so strange about, for you.
Yeah,
because as you mentioned, you grew up in a community where you saw, or the norm is, people of color lives in your community, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I remember when I was a kid and I watched shows like Beverly Hills 90210, I was like, this is taking place on Mars. I have no idea where this community lives. To me, it was like science fiction. I was like, okay, I've never seen this California before in my life, but this is what people think California is.
Yeah. For a writer of color like yourself, what do you still aim to do, aside from America is Not the Heart, in terms of your works and writings?
I think I'm working a little bit on what I thought was a sequel to the book, but now I think it's turning into sci-fi. So I think I'm mixing genres a little bit. I've always been a big sort of sci-fi fan. I was a big Star Trek fan growing up and a big X-Men fan. So I like the idea. So maybe some Asian superheroes from me. You never know.
Wow.
So I think I am working on different genres. And I think I'd like to work on more, I think, contemporary issues. I think right, the, you know, America's Not the Heart, it takes place mostly in the 70s and the 90s. So in a way, it's a kind of a period novel. I had to do a lot of sort of historical research. I think, in the future, or at least for the next book, to write something that's taking place more in our current era.
And maybe talk about the millennials, as they say.
Yeah, the millennials. I think the millennials are really interesting. Filipino hipsters, I think. But I also think, for example, things like, I don't know if this is as sort of known in Australia, the Filipino workers who do content moderation, or things like Facebook, and it's a really interesting phenomenon where I think it's largely Filipino workers who do, yeah, essentially content moderation, so that certain like hyper violent or hypersexual images don't reach the kind of mainstream feed, which I think is really horrifying and fascinating. So I think I'd like to write like that.
Are there a lot of this in America? Like content editors or writers?
I think a lot of that work, some of it does happen in America, but I think there were a few articles recently that were talking about how a lot of them are being outsourced to the Philippines, a little bit like call centers.
Yeah, that's good to know.
So yeah, it's just interesting to think about sort of contemporary Filipino issues in the diaspora and in America and in the Philippines.
Yeah, because I think with movies, there are already a lot of Filipinos at the back end of these movies, isn't it? So
sure, yeah.
Maybe for Filipino writers or content writers to be out there, really, it's not really, it's not shocking. It is always possible.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's so many great Filipino writers, and you see Filipino faces on screen, and I'm always happy when I can do. So we're definitely out here.
Yes. And for our listeners who wants to learn more about Elaine Castillo, where they can follow you or find you?
Well, first of all, thank you for pronouncing my name right. It's only Filipinos who ever know how to pronounce my name right. It always makes me happy when I hear someone say Castillo, because most people say Castillo, because that's the Spanish way of pronouncing it. And I always want to say, oh, no, but Filipinos pronounce it Castillo.
Yeah.
Well, I have an Instagram, so it's _ Elaine Castillo, and that's at Instagram. And otherwise, there's like a whole author page on the kind of Penguin Random House, I think, page for me as an author.
Yes, and definitely you'll be at the Sydney Writers Festival happening on the 29th of April to the 5th of May.
That's right. I definitely will. I can't wait to meet Filipino Australians and Australian readers. I'm really excited.
Thank you very much, Elaine Castillo, Filipino-American writer.
Oh, thank you so much, Annalyn. This was amazing.
sbs.com.au/Filipino
sbs.com.au